You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Paul Scott. Paul, thanks so much for being with me today.
Hi, Brainerd. Thank you for inviting me to have a conversation. Yeah, good.
Paul, we're going to talk about your show, of course, that's currently running at HB 381 in Tribeca in New York. I was really excited to look through your work. Of course, it's a two-person show, your work and Caroline's work. So to begin with, I'd love to hear about your relationship with Caroline. You two have been artists that have been in dialogue for quite a while, right? Because this is such an interesting pairing of work. It seems a really interesting contrast. So just curious about the dialogue that both of you have over the years.
Yeah, well, we've known each other, for 20-odd years, I think. And we first met when I used to be a visiting professor at the Art Academy in Bergen, and I think Caroline was doing her MA there, and that's when we first met. And then I think partly because of our interest in using the same materials that this blue and white transware, printed ceramic transwares, we've continued a dialogue and a conversation since then. And actually, we planned to have a show together in Stockholm about 10 years ago, and that didn't actually work out. So, so the idea has been mooted, but we've both been busy, and it's taken a long time to realize, really. That's really, we've seen each other at various times, and then strangely, I was after Bergen, I became a visiting professor in the Art Academy in Oslo. And then Caroline actually was a professor there as well for a year while I was there. So, we've known each other a long time. Anyway, I'm rambling. Sorry.
That's fine. No, it's good to know. And so to just talk briefly about the contrast between both of your styles as I look through the show, and they are, quite close to one another. They're contrasted. They seem to be, different sides of a coin, right? As if I'm understanding correctly, yours is additive, in a sense. You're combining. You're doing a number of things that are adding on, and her work is somewhat subtractive, if that's an appropriate term to talk about the contrast between your work.
Yeah, I mean, Glenn Adamson, who wrote the essay for the catalogue, was really the person who crystallised that observation. And I don't think either of us had really thought about it that much before. But basically, we use a common material, which is transferware, which is this blue and white printed ceramics. And Caroline removes material, and I both remove and add material. So, I came to transferware as an artist. I've always worked with print, and I've always worked with imagery, and I got sucked into ceramics while I was a student, and I carried on working with print and with images and narratives when working in ceramics. And when I first started, I made my own transfers, my own prints, and I put them on plates. And then I realized that actually I could alter plates themselves. So then I started buying plates with patterns on already, and then started altering them. And then I think probably because of Caroline, who was actually removing stuff, I started doing that more as well. So, yeah, and I think Caroline's work is more, I think she described it as being more poetic. I think she says that, she knows that a piece has worked when she doesn't really understand it. Whereas in my case, I'm very interested in the messages and meanings that appear on transwares, and I'm interested in updating some of those messages and meanings for the 21st century.
I want to talk about some of those, some of those meanings and narratives. But before we go into that, transferware, I have a sense of how that will work. But can you explain that to me a little more? The process of transferring an image itself. How does that work?
Yeah. So transferware. Historically, transferware grew out of a desire in factories and ceramic factories to sort of replicate painted Chinese porcelain. So in the late 18th century, Chinese porcelain was coming across the Atlantic, coming across the sorry, oceans to the United States and also to Britain. And it was really big business. And the potteries in Europe were trying to imitate porcelain and trying to imitate this wonderful blue and white landscapes and patterns. And transferware was developed as a way to do that. And it involved engraving on a copper plate and transferring an image from the copper plate onto a ceramic surface underneath a glaze. To cut a long story short, it started out as imitating Chinese porcelain. So that's why you have classic patterns that most people will be familiar with, like the willow pattern, which is that chinoiserie pattern of a Chinese-esque landscape with figures crossing a bridge. And then gradually, as the technology evolved in Staffordshire, it started replicating, European and other landscapes as it became more sophisticated. And it basically transferwares were part of a new media of the 19th century. And they disseminated images, into people's houses, and people would use them at dinnerware, and their tables. And what particularly interested me, as far as the American transferwares, is that for a period in the early 19th century, Staffordshire potters, after the American War of Independence, Staffordshire potters, started making plates and platters with pictures of America on them, and they became very, very collectible at the end of the century. Lots of museums have fine collections, including the Met in New York and, Philadelphia Art Museum and, I've been interested in updating some of the American transferwares in particular.
Yeah, that's what's so interesting, these kind of American transferwares, which, now I realize I also grew up with, seen in friends' homes as kind of souvenir plates, right? It was something that you would also pick up as souvenirs from traveling.
Yeah, so what happened in the early 19th century is you got this whole body of dark blue images of American landscapes on plates and platters. And then at the end of the 19th century, people like R.T. Haynes Halsey, who later set up the American wing at the Metropolitan Museum, he was a very passionate collector, along with people like Kellogg and Randolph Hearst and people like that. It became very, very collectible. And collectible by wealthy people, wealthy men, which is strange, collecting domestic tableware. As a spin-off from that, at the start of the 20th century, then people, Staffordshire potters, started making souvenir wares of American towns and American cities, and they were generally commissioned by American stores and companies, and then they were made at places like Wedgwood and Spode and stuff like that. And companies like Roland Marcellus were commissioned and imported stuff to the States, and those souvenir plates are sort of part of that. Yeah, they're part of the revival of interest in the early 19th century stuff.
So to talk about some of these, because then, of course, there's, you're commenting on these, there's narratives strung throughout these. There's one called New American Scenery, Souvenir of Portland, Oregon, Black Lives Matter. The title is a bit longer than that. So let's talk about this one, because this is a very specific narrative that's happening here. We're talking about the protests in the United States, in Oregon, and Black Lives Matter, and how those have continued to echo. But we're seeing a combination of images here in the style or format of some of the souvenir plates we're talking about, like as if you were visiting the World's Fair or something like that, correct?
Yeah, I mean so what that piece is, it's an original plate made by, well, it's a Roland Marcellus branded plate from the early 20th century that would have been made in Staffordshire, and it's called a souvenir of Portland in Oregon, and there are cartouches around the central scene, and the cartouches depict certain scenes around Portland, Oregon. One of them is a statue that's in the park called The Coming of the White Man, which shows Native Americans welcoming white settlers. and that statue actually exists in the park in Portland. And then, you know, during the Black Lives Matter protests, I saw people in Portland. I saw people protesting about the killing, and then you know, Donald Trump sent in troops, and broke up protests, and it seemed to me that plate needed an update, and so I erased part of the pattern. And I superimposed a screen print of the riot police or the militia that Trump had sent in to update the plate for the 21st century, basically.
And it also comments, of course. Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense, and it's just fascinating and really beautiful to me, because it also the message is, of course, very different than was ever on these kind of plates. These kind of plates had a very if shallow is the right word, you know, had a kind of souvenir aesthetic, which was simply about I've been here and saw something that was a famous or a statue or something, whereas this is looking beneath the surface, and this runs throughout the show of your work, correct?
Yeah, I would say so. And I would say is that transferware, that's transferwares from the early 19th century and transferwares of the early 20th century, tell a particular version of history. You know, they tell a white settler version of history. And, you know, there are no, you know, there are no indigenous people, you know, celebrated on transferwares. There are no black people celebrated on transferwares. They are a particular version of American history, and it seemed to me that in the 21st century, if I'm going to work, you know, I'm working with this material, that I should update it, that it should be more representative, and it should tell the stories that weren't told or celebrated on the original transferwares. And so that's, some of them do that. I mean, you know, others of them. You know, there's one that's called residual waste, and that's what's put on a pearlware shell edge platter, and that's got an oil refinery on it, and you know, a truck driving across the front of it with the label residual waste, which alludes to the fact that you know, our consumption of oil and gas and what have you is, you know, is having an effect on the atmosphere and with global warming and things like that. So, you know,
And there's something residual waste that also has what looks like, you know, the stains from that ecological damage, right? We have a brownish color.
So what happens is that I buy antique tablewares, so, you know, on eBay or in antique shops, you know, and then what I do is that I refire these plates. So, you know, some of these plates and platters, and that residual waste one, that's a platter from about 1830 that was made in Staffordshire, and of course over the years people have used that platter for you know, for dinner, and there's been gravy and on it and sauces and stuff like that. And when the, sometimes these earthenware plates, the glaze sort of crazes and cracks, and those materials, that those food things soak into the ceramic body. So when I refire some plates, the material, like the food stuff that's been soaked into those plates over hundreds, over the last couple of hundred years, they can actually cause the plate to become stained. So sometimes when I take a piece out of the kiln, it's got these blooms in the surface. And in the case of that residual waste, that was one of those pieces that had residual waste actually in the body of the object. And so, you know, when those things happen, they help me decide how I'm going to use that piece of tableware. So in that case, because there's residual waste in the glaze that looks like a bloom in the glaze, like an orange glow underneath the glaze, that alludes to the waste that comes from our burning of fossil fuels. Other times, what happens when I refire a plate is that it may be, because they're so old, sometimes they crack in the kiln or they break. And so I did a whole series of them, which is about fracking, which is about cracking the earth's surface. So sometimes when I refire the original antique wares, the result of the firing helps me decide the subject matter that's going to go on the fired plate.
Yeah, it's so interesting, the combination of right chance and more there. There's another one, sampler jug, that I wanted to talk about. That one was just fascinating to me. Images on the interior, on the inside, on the bottom, as well as tremendous amount of collaging, really, right? That's on the handle, that's surrounding the entire jug. This is quite different than the rest of the works, it seems to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, all the works are collaged in one sense, because, you know, I work with prints, and I work with screen prints, and I work with what are called transfers, which is about transferring images which are printed onto paper onto the ceramic surface and then firing them. So nearly every piece that I make is collaged to a certain extent. But those sampler jugs are yes, very, very heavily collaged. And what they do is that they reference a phenomena of printed ceramics, when they made prints for ceramics, very often they made them for specific tableware forms, so that they would make prints to fit a 12-inch plate or a 10-inch plate. But then sometimes, you know, the factory would make a tableware set which had a big platter in the middle of it. Well, it was not cost effective to employ an engraver, to make a copper plate, especially for one big plate or for just a small number of pieces. So what they would do is that they would collage prints intended for smaller objects to fill the surface of larger objects. And this was going on like in the early 19th century, long before artists, you know, were playing with collage. Decorators were collaging in ceramic factories. So there's that that they reference. And also in the 20th century, you would find that factories would collage disparate patterns on plates or platters, which they would then give to salespeople to sort of be able to sell the work. So say, oh, these are the kind of patterns that we could do. And you'd have all kind of juxtapositions of patterns which had nothing to do with each other, but they'd all be randomly assembled on a plate for the salesman to try and sell things. And then the other thing, finally, was that within factories themselves, they would test patterns and colours. So all those, and they would be on a similar kind of thing, where you'd have random patterns assembled together on a ceramic platter or form. And so basically, you know, I've been referencing those, and the jug itself is a piece that rather than an antique piece, is actually a piece that I helped to create with a mold maker who made them for me, and it's made in a factory in Stoke. And then basically it gives me a huge surface onto which to collage. And the collage, I call them samplers. I call them sampler jugs. And the one that's in HB381 is a collage of patterns and prints that I've done about the New American Scenery, throughout the New American Scenery series. And it includes borders and patterns that I created specially for the series, and it includes subject matters which appeared on plates and platters as well. So it's completely covered, yeah. And it's a one-off sampler jug, it's called.
Yeah. I just love that. I love that piece. I mean, yeah, it makes sense. Yeah, it does. And all of it makes sense. And it's a fascinating process that you're using, that both of you are using. There's one other work that I wanted to talk about. The title of it is The Sleep of Reason. And this one is has a crack through the middle. The technique you're using is wabi-sabi here, right? The Japanese technique, if I understand correctly, of mending a broken plate or broken object in such a way that the mend is clear. Can you tell me a little bit about this? Because this also adds something to the narrative of the plate, right? It's not something that I imagine would be done with an American souvenir. We would just glue it back together, or a British souvenir, right? We wouldn't use the wabi-sabi technique. So can you tell me a little bit about it? Because this is quite beautiful and seems to add a further narrative to what we're looking at.
Yeah, okay. So what we would call it is it's kintsugi, or in my case, kari kintsugi, which is like a quick kintsugi. But kintsugi is a Japanese technique whereby broken ceramic forms are repaired using a special lacquer and then gold. And what that does is that it highlights the place where the object has been broken, but in the process of repairing it, the process of repairing it makes the object more precious than the original. You know, in the West here, when we break things, you know, there's a tendency, certainly in a throwaway culture of the late 20th and early 21st century, has been basically you break it, you throw it away. But of course, in many cultures, objects that have been used over a long period of time actually become more precious. And when something's broken, there is a sort of an imperative to repair it, and it becomes part of that object's story. So the object, when it's been repaired, is more valuable than the object that wasn't repaired. In the case of the plate that you're referring to, there's quite a lot going on in that, because it's called, the title of the series is called The Sleep of Reason, which is after the Spanish artist Goya, who did a series of etchings. And The Sleep of Reason refers to the message on his etching was the sleep of reason produces monsters. And it seems to me at the moment the sleep of reason produces monsters, and the sleep of reason produces the news. And the direct reference there is to on the bottom part of the place, you'll find that there's a felled woodland, a felled forest. And the reference is to the move by the present US government to open up areas of natural and protected forest for logging, many of which are very, very rich natural environments that really should be protected. And so it's a piece about the destructive logging, the destructive unnecessary logging that is about to be permitted by the American government. And the kintsugi, the broken place, is really a reference to the fact that we're breaking the environment, and we're breaking the world, if you like. And people are making money out of it, and that's where the gold comes in. So, yeah, there's all kinds of things happening in that, but basically it's a comment on the notion that we can just go out there and destroy everything that's natural and to enrich, well, not all of us, just to enrich some people who are already very rich anyway.
Thank you. Yeah, it's, of course, quite dark, right? It's dark what's happening, and yeah, and that message is rings clear. It's such a pleasure to talk to you about this, Paul. Of course, for listeners, there's links to learn more and go see the show, right? It's up now and running. And I want to ask you one more question before we go, a little off topic. Yeah. What are you reading at the moment?
Oh, okay. Yeah, what am I reading? Yeah, I usually got a couple of books on the go at once, actually. I'm reading, well, one book I'm reading is a book by the British ceramist and potter Edmund de Waal, and it's a small tome called An Archive, and it's basically a book about his research and the materials that haven't been printed or published before. Edmund de Waal wrote a book called The Hair with the Amber Eyes, and there's a couple of other books as well. So this is a very nice, for me, it's a fascinating little read, because like Edmund, I do lots of research before I make my things, and it's nice to read and follow another artist's journey. His work's very different to mine, but we both have similar working processes. And then the other thing, the other book that I'm reading is Philip Pullman's the last book in his trilogy, The Book of Dust. Is it called The Rose? Is it was it The Rose Fields? I think it's called. But anyway, it's the last trilogy, the last book in a trilogy by Philip Pullman. Which is a sort of, fictional,
Thanks so much, Paul. I want to wish you well with this show, and thank you so much for your time talking with me today. I really appreciate and love the work in the show, and I hope all listeners can make the effort to go see this show, because you have to see it in person. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Brian. Yeah, it's been great to speak to you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.